In the coming week, the U.S. and South Korea hold military drills. Talks continue on reviving the Iran nuclear deal. And Ukraine celebrates Independence Day. It's August 18th and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, let's kick off this week's show by discussing Ulchi Freedom Shield. It's a set of joint military exercises in South Korea that involve U.S. and South Korean military forces. The operation marks a return to joint military exercises that had been scaled back or halted during the Trump administration. Ulchi Freedom Shield will take place in the shadow of growing concerns about North Korea's nuclear and missile programs, as well as increased tensions between the United States and China. What should we make of these exercises, Bob?
Well, in, let's say, pre-Trump era, or certainly pre-pandemic era, these were normal exercises. They had sort of serially produced concern from North Korea about what North Korea considered their provocative nature. But they're the types of things that were happening on a regular basis. And we should note, anywhere there are major deployments of U.S. or other forces, for that matter, drills are sort of a feature. We're going to see drills taking place towards the end of this month that involve, I just heard an announcement, involve Russia, China, and even India. Joint drills, for example. But in this case, it's an important signal by the U.S. about its intention to keep the alliance with South Korea vital, to keep it vigorous, and to signal to North Korea that the U.S. is in the region active and ready to defend against what it sees as sort of provocative actions from the North Korean side. So it's kind of dangerous signaling, certainly, but by the same token, it is certainly within the alliance, the U.S.-South Korean alliance, it's appropriate. And as a reminder, there's something upwards of 28,000 U.S. troops based in South Korea. There are a lot of military vehicles, land and sea, and a lot of South Korean troops are involved in these drills as well. And so it's very important. I'll add one more thing, which is our colleague Scott Snyder has a new post up on CFR's Asia Unbound blog about a gesture from the new South Korean administration towards the North, actually, about a sweeping new, what he called audacious plan for rapprochement, for really creating peace on the peninsula by South Korea offering all sorts of sweeping economic gestures and North Korea in return denuclearizing. Scott also kind of punctures that offer in terms of why the North won't accept it.
So Bob, explain to me why then North Korea responded by testing two cruise missiles, which seems to be part of a real sort of step up in the rate of missile testing of all kinds.
People who are close North Korea watchers say that there seems to be a clear step by North Korea to double down on its military posture and to indicate its might, its strengthening capability in missile capability and sort of throw weight and so forth. There's a lot of expectation that it's going to resume nuclear testing, which I believe it hasn't done since 2017 and was also suspended as a gesture as part of these talks that took place between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. But now it's about the North showing its capabilities and sort of posing this as a signal that it is not to be messed with. The other side should be very careful about what sort of military positions it takes, but also to disabuse themselves of this notion that the North is going to climb down from its capabilities. In fact, it's looking for concessions on all sorts of things involving, especially the U.S. involvement in the hemisphere.
Are we concerned, Bob, that Pyongyang is going to try to test the new South Korean president, President Yoon?
That's one of the feelings. I mean, it's one of the thoughts about why he might have used the Liberation Day speech, his first, to come out with this initiative about providing both economic assistance, but also phasing out North Korea's nuclear program. It's seen as North Korea, you know, a firm gesture and also a test because Yoon, as many people have noted, is a neophyte, really, in terms of statecraft. And so I think they are going to try to take his measure. Kim Jong-un himself was certainly a neophyte, although he taking office or succeeding to the Kim dynasty as he did in his late 20s, he sort of quickly asserted himself and sort of made a power play to assert his strength. Yoon obviously operates in a democratic system and is trying out a different tack. The predecessor administration, it should be noted, in South Korea, it tried all sorts of ways, conciliatory gestures and otherwise, to try to engage North Korea economically and so forth without making any sort of major, certainly compared to Yoon, major calls for concessions on the North Korean side. That was met by further kind of militarized response from North Korea. So it's every expectation that in a region where tensions are already high over Taiwan, North Korea is going to start to saber-rattle itself a lot more loudly.
Well, let's talk about that, Bob, the greater regional implications. You mentioned Taiwan. China is clearly paying attention to what happens on the Korean Peninsula. It views it as its neighborhood. It has at times suggested it's willing to put pressure on Pyongyang to ratchet back its aggressiveness. But it seems recently the Chinese have not been forward-leaning when it comes to dealing with North Korea. Indeed, they may be quite happy to see North Korea absorbing a lot of time for the Biden administration.
That's a really good point, Jim. I mean, there was a period of time not too long ago that there was a great deal of consensus about how to move the needle on North Korea, consensus in the U.S. policy community, moving the needle on North Korea in terms of pressuring it vis-a-vis China, sort of U.S. engaging with China, whether you go back to the early part of this century in the six-party talks that China was involved in, or you go even a little bit later than that, up to through the Obama years, where there was a sense that, well, China could have some positive impact. And there, as you indicated, Jim, China did take some measures in those regards. There were efforts through the UN Security Council to squeeze North Korea further with sanctions. There is a real change, though, in the tone and in the sort of landscape of the region. China is extremely concerned and has ratcheted up both its rhetoric and its actions, its own missile testing in the neighborhood of Taiwan. And so we're in a different scenario here, and there's going to be a premium on communication across all sort of lines and keeping those contacts, military to military contacts, open. And I'm talking about not just U.S. South Korea and so forth, but also U.S. to China.
Well, we're not seeing a lot of high-level exchanges between the United States and China in the wake of the Pelosi visit to Taiwan. And I will note that China would like nothing more than to be able to break the U.S.-South Korea military alliance. China clearly would like to see a South Korea that looks to Beijing rather than Washington. But for Beijing, the problem they have is that South Korea's new president, President Yoon, is calling for closer relations with the United States, unlike his predecessor, President Moon, who would hope to come in and have good relations with both Beijing and Washington. I think President Yoon has decided that South Korea's future lies with very good relations with the United States because of a fear of Chinese belligerence, of Chinese coercion. So if you're in South Korea and you look at Taiwan, you worry that you could face similar pressure. Now, obviously, Chinese claim Taiwan as part of China. There's no claim by China that South Korea is part of China. However, the Chinese do have a view that the neighboring countries should be, in essence, tributary states toward China.
No, that's right, Jim. And as has been noted, that kind of Chinese assertiveness is only going to get starker as we get up to the October China Party Congress, and it's widely expected to anoint Xi as a leader in longstanding and sort of provide him with powers and a sense of power that Chinese leaders have not had since the Mao era, really. And Xi has already been indicating Taiwan is a top priority. And it's in some ways making it easier for people who might have been on the fence, policymakers in South Korea, for example, to be able to support tightening the U.S. relationship. These drills are a way of indicating that. You're also seeing some speculation that you could see a new effort on rapprochement between South Korea and Japan, these two U.S. allies who have not had great relations dating back to abuses committed by Japanese forces in World War II. And so that's another thing that could be an outgrowth of China's activities, China's behavior.
It certainly is, Bob. And here, since we're talking a little bit about U.S.-China, let me just note that there's an article out in Foreign Affairs by Jessica Chen Weiss, which suggests that the United States may want to be careful in avoiding turning relations with China into a zero-sum competition because that really increases the potential for conflict. So I'll just reference that for people who want to dive into the argument about where are U.S.-China relations going.
It's a really important point. And also, I think people do lose sight of the fact that the U.S. and China have been engaged in a lot of different areas. Climate is cited, obviously, repeatedly as a really important area where these both high-emitting countries can make common cause and make a difference. Those have been sort of shelved recently. But these two countries, and here's a segue to another topic for us this week, Jim, they are both involved in the diplomacy with Iran over the return to the Iran nuclear deal. And these negotiations have really picked up in recent days. European Union officials say they have submitted a final version of a revived nuclear agreement for both parties' approval, U.S. and Iran. And they received a written response from Iran, although we don't know what that statement says. And there's a bit of cynicism, if not speculation, that you know the Iranians might still be making demands that cannot be met by the U.S. side. So, Jim, what do you think we're going to see as it relates to the revival of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal?
Well, Bob, they say that diplomacy is often about kicking the can down the road until conditions make it possible to do a deal. But sometimes you can get to the end of the road without conditions changing. And that's the position we may be in right now with the Iran nuclear deal. Negotiations reopened 16 months ago. The Biden administration was hopeful that it could strike a quick deal with the Iranians. I think that was motivated partly by a desire to try to limit the number of major foreign policy challenges the administration had to face. They wanted to at least put this on hold so they could focus more attention on issues like dealing with China. But that game plan didn't hold up. The Iranians had an election, got a new hardline president, and we've been going through very contentious negotiations since then. But it appears that we may have come to the end of the road. I'll note that late last month, the EU High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, Josep Borrell, who's facilitating negotiations, said, let me quote him here, "I have concluded that the space for additional significant compromises has been exhausted." And I think that signals, in essence, that the EU has given or offered as much in the way of concessions as it can possibly offer and still keep the Americans on board. So the question right now is, do the Iranians take up the offer? If they do, the United States has indicated that it is willing to sign on. Now, the deal it would sign on to wouldn't solve the Iran nuclear program. Keep in mind that the provisions in the original deal were set to sunset or expire over the next 5 to 7 years. That would still be the case. But from the American point of view, what it would do is at least put this Iran problem on hold, at least the nuclear portion of the Iran problem on hold for a bit longer. And again, if you're in the White House and you're looking out and you have to deal with China, you have to deal with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, you have to deal with climate change and a variety of other issues, if you can get an issue and you can at least sort of put it in stasis for a while, that can seem to be a win. The question, of course, is what happens if Iran looks at the deal and basically tosses the paper back across the table to the Europeans and says, not good enough. Does the status quo just persist? Or do we see one or the other of the sides decide to change the status quo? It's unlikely, one would think, that the Biden administration would want to change the status quo, because that would likely mean using force against Iran. And the administration, again, simply has a foreign policy inbox that is too full. The really interesting question is, what if the Iranians decide at this point, this deal is done, they're going to pursue their nuclear activities, kick the IAEA out and the rest, then how would Washington respond? So this could be a very dangerous time. Now, keep in mind that from the vantage point of Tehran, they are also quite aware of how busy and how challenged American foreign policy is right now, how much time is spent by U.S. diplomats and military officials worrying about Ukraine, worrying about the threat to Europe that Russia might pose, worrying about the consequences of greater Chinese aggression in activity in East and Southeast Asia. So the question is, do the Iranians see this potentially as a time in which they can push their advantage because they calculate that Washington can't afford to respond? Now, of course, that assessment, if that is the one they make, may be correct. It may also be wrong. There are plenty of cases in the annals of history of adversaries miscalculating what the bottom line is on the other side.
Jim, there's a lot of good points in there. I would just add a couple of quick things, which is, it still seems like we don't really know to what extent Iran's sort of tipping point is economically before it needs to have the various sanctions arrayed against it eased, and that rejoining the deal would allow. It was noted at the beginning of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, you know, that the deal started getting new impetus as well for a number of reasons, including Iran seeing an opportunity perhaps to take advantage of higher oil prices as well. They're still higher. They're not as high as they were, but Do we think that that set of issues and Iran's, let's face it, Iran's got a economy in the tank. It's got a lot of stresses across the board societally and otherwise. Does it have the stamina to be able to hold out? Or, you know, can the relatively minor concessions it would need to make to rejoin the deal, can that be enough and palatable for this regime that, you, as you rightly say, is a hardline regime?
Well, Bob, I think one of the things to keep in mind is that the Iranian regime rests on opposition to the United States. The United States is the great Satan, to borrow the phrase, and this is a regime that doesn't want to be fully integrated into the international economy. Indeed, in many ways, it would threaten the political bases of the regime. There's a really good piece by Kareem Sajapour, who's at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, that appeared in the New York Times, that goes through and talks about, I think in a quite clear way, how the Iranian theocracy depends upon this hostility. And obviously, there may be a point of economic pain that would be too great for the regime, but it's also clear that the regime can tolerate a lot of pain, and it is willing to use the coercive tools of the state to crush opposition. We saw that most clearly back in 2009. I would not underestimate the willingness of this regime to squelch political dissent or its ability to squelch political dissent. Now, again, if you go back to the Trump administration, its idea of maximum pressure is that if you really squeeze the regime, it would crack. The public would rise up. They would cry uncle. Despite really unprecedented levels of economic coercion, the Iranian regime didn't crack. And so that gets us back to this question of, at the end of the day, what is it that the Ayatollah and his followers are willing to accept when it comes to this offer? How are they calculating their interests? It doesn't matter how we calculate how they should think about the challenges they face or how they should think about the burdens on their population. What is going to matter are the calculations they make about their self-interest.
The two other parties I would note that we haven't mentioned yet that have a keen interest in this are Israel and Saudi Arabia. President Biden visited both places. We know he talked to the Israelis about the Iran issue. We assume he talked to the Saudis as well. One would think that they have contingencies in place. Maybe they are fast-forwarding them as they get ready for something to happen related to this deal.
Well, we will note that the Israelis have a long track record of unilateral military action to address threats that Israel faces. And what has been notable is that Israel has not opted to take that course against Iran. Variety of reasons, difficulty of success, and the like. It's not at all clear that if the deal does not materialize and the Biden administration chooses to pursue the status quo, that Israel itself is going to go out and engage in a military operation. I mean, it's not impossible, but I wouldn't assume that that is a likely outcome. In the case of the Saudis, I think what you're seeing is hedging. The Saudis have in recent months had some exchanges with the Iranians, as I understand it, and it's largely because there is some concern in Riyadh that the United States will not come to their defense at the end of the day. And if you go back to the Trump administration, you may recall the Iranians struck at the Saudi oil production facilities in the eastern part of the country, took, I believe, half of Saudi Arabia's oil production offline for a day or two. And the Trump administration essentially looked the other way. And my sense is, talking to people who follow Saudi Arabia much more closely than I do, this was a real wake-up call in Riyadh, that they thought they had an ironclad security guarantee from the United States, and maybe they don't. And again, on the score of U.S.-Saudi relations, I would just recommend a piece our colleagues Stephen Cook and Martin Indyk did, looking at the frayed nature of U.S.-Saudi relations, the concern about that compact having come apart at the seams, and can it and should it be resurrected?
I would just add to that great list of content a piece in The Economist this summer about the Saudi leader, the heir apparent to the leadership of Saudi Arabia, bin Salman, and sort of what motivates him as well. All of it adds up to a very interesting picture of a region, a very disturbing region, and we're going to hear a lot more in the coming days.
Yeah, certainly. And again, I think one of the big concerns, fears, and in some places hopes, is that the United States is not only less interested in the region, but may be on its way out. But Bob, let's move away from the Middle East and talk about Ukraine. Ukrainians will mark their Independence Day on August 24th. The holiday was created to celebrate the country's official independence from the Soviet Union back in 1991. Ironically, August the 24th also marks 6 months since the Russians invaded Ukraine. Most recently, we have seen the Ukrainians begin to take the war to the Russians. There's been talk about counteroffenses. Ukrainian special forces have conducted operations in Crimea, which the Russians seized back in 2014, claim as Russian territory, which Ukraine does not acknowledge. Do we anticipate seeing escalating tensions in Ukraine on the anniversary of Independence Day?
I think it's highly expected, Jim. It is certainly in keeping with the way Russia has marked major events or even major visits, although they've seemed to have held fire during the current ongoing visit of the UN Secretary General to Ukraine. But previous visits, they have lobbed shells nearby. There have been high-level visits of that nature. Also, right after they reached agreement on releasing grain from Ukrainian ports, they had introduced some bombing that had created a lot of concern. We should note, ships are leaving Ukrainian ports now filled with badly needed grain, needed in places like the Middle East and North Africa. But it's still an extremely tough situation across the front lines between Russia and Ukraine. One could expect to see a ramping up of activity on around the Independence Day. There have been reports of movements of Russian missiles closer to the front lines and into neighboring Belarus, which has offered itself up as a staging ground for Russian troops and materiel. So there's a lot of expectation that that date will be a date for a significant Russian gesture. As you know, Jim, it's also maybe a way for the Russians to say to some payback for the what we've seen happening recently in Crimea, which kind of shocked certainly the Russians as well as others, Ukraine's ability to mount sabotage attacks, especially on an airfield in Crimea. And I recall we talked early on after the invasion, Jim, about at the time when it was expected that Russia would sweep into a military victory relatively quickly, that it would then have to deal with the sort of the porcupine effect of how Ukrainians would strike back. And so maybe we're seeing a little bit of porcupine in Crimea, but Russia has also been showing that it is fully willing to pulverize Ukrainian cities, certainly in the eastern and Donbas region, and then depopulate them of Ukrainians after they consolidate power. So we're dealing with a situation where certainly in another 6 months of war is definitely to be seen. I think your recent podcast on the President's Inbox with Steve Sestanovich indicates why that is so. And then the very fact of a Ukrainian Independence Day is something that is neuralgic for President Putin and his close advisors who don't see Ukrainians' existence as a real thing and want it to not exist and want its what they call its fascist or Nazi or what have you leadership to be expunged and have the country, you know, return to the Russian fold. So we're looking at an anniversary with a lot of meaning. It is interesting that it's exactly 6 months after the invasion that they're marking their 31st anniversary as an independent state. And they're marking that anniversary with up to 25% of their territory occupied by Russian forces.
I imagine, Bob, that many Ukrainians would say that Putin doesn't have to wait to the anniversary to act in a barbarous way against Ukraine. And we'll know just before we sat down to do this podcast that Russian missiles hit a dormitory in Kharkiv, a clear civilian target. And again, Ukrainians have argued time and again that President Putin and the Russian military have been waging inhumane war against Ukraine by going after targets that they know to be civilian in nature. So we're in this situation, I think, where this war is going to drag out because the Russians haven't been able to achieve a decisive military victory, even with their scaled back ambitions. And there's a lot of talk about how they have succeeded in taking over Luhansk and they were pressing forward in Donetsk, but they were expending great amount of ammunition to basically cover very little in terms of territory. The Ukrainians fighting them tooth and nail. And again, now there's talk about the Ukrainians pursuing counteroffensives that will put the Russians on their heels. Russians facing shortages of ammunition. Ukraine also facing challenges on that score. But if you're on the Ukrainian side, the odds are pretty good. You're going to get not only more ammunition, you're going to get higher quality ammunition weapons going forward because of support from the West. The Russians at this point have not been able to turn to anyone else. to get basically more and better weapons. Yes, they've apparently gotten drone technology from Iran, but that doesn't seem to be a game changer. As best we can tell, the Chinese are not providing the Russians with military weapons. I don't know if they're providing them with intelligence. That's always an impossible thing to know sitting on the sidelines. But the Russians are in a difficult position. So this is likely to be a war of attrition. And then that gets us into the question of, can you negotiate a ceasefire? And if you can negotiate a ceasefire, how long might it last? And again, there's also the issue of, if Putin can't win in eastern Ukraine, does he try to scramble the nature of the contest? Does he take even greater steps in trying to coerce Europe? Do they try to use more information operations to try to split European solidarity? Do they make a dash through the Sulawesi Gap to create a corridor to Kaliningrad? Of course, that would be a major escalation and obviously invoke and involve NATO's Article 5.
I think you've laid it out. It is, by all appearances, entering this war of attrition phase. And it does seem like, although the Ukrainian capabilities are improving in terms of arms and the sophistication of their arms, that they have no plans to engage any sort of major battlefield offensive against Russia. Our colleague Max Boot writes recently in the Washington Post about that very nature, that it looks like Ukraine is going to be content, at least for the time being, to be trying to mount effective, you know, sort of sporadic attacks where they can, but is not looking to have a deadly, even if it potentially is effective, a deadly attack on Russian positions in open battle. That sort of battle is not seemingly going to happen. And so that, what does that do? That leads you to an ongoing drawn out battle. It will be worth watching the visit of the UN Secretary General at the moment in Ukraine, where I believe he's taking soundings on any sort of peace prospects. He's coming initially under the guise, among other things, of looking at how the agreement on freeing up food from Ukrainian ports is going, which is why Turkey's leader is also in the country. But I think he's very much interested in finding out whether that in any way opens up some daylight for some sort of a ceasefire, a meaningful one that can then lead the way towards some sort of, you know, end to this war. But it's really not expected.
Well, I think there's been a lot of speculation, Bob, that Putin will sometime this fall offer up some kind of ceasefire or peace deal, not because he wants a true ceasefire or peace deal, but he's hoping to basically put the Ukrainians in a box and put the burden, presumably, on the Ukrainians for wanting to continue the war. And the hope would be that this somehow would lead to divisions within the European Union, particularly given concerns about a very cold winter and the ability to keep themselves warm. And we'll see if we have that kind of deft diplomatic maneuver coming out of the Kremlin. To this point, it seems to be more talked about in Western academic and policymaking circles than it seems to be being discussed in the Kremlin.
And it is the European theater, which I think we'll get into in a moment, is a very important place to watch in terms of the degree to which it continues to stay strong in both the support of Ukraine to maintain sanctions against Russia, to sort of see this conflict as what it is, which is conflict against aggression, against the sort of rules-based international order. As opaque as that sometimes sounds, I think it's become a very real thing for Europeans. I'll note I was recently in Ireland, of all places, where I saw more Ukrainian flags than I expected to see as well, a sign of solidarity there, the westernmost EU member showing its solidarity. So this is going to be a very important fall period for the reasons you mentioned.
Well, that's an important point, Bob, because the Ukrainians can succeed as long as the West remains united and has the will to support them. And that's, I think, something that the Kremlin hopes to challenge.
Well, Jim, we've talked our way into the audience figure of the week portion of the podcast. This is where listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, our audience selected Germany's 3 nuke plants. Jim, why do you think they selected that?
Our audience selected that figure, Bob, because the news out of Berlin is that the German government is going to change longstanding policy and not close the last 3 remaining nuclear plants at the end of this year, as has been long scheduled, but are going to keep them open. And this is a big change in German policy, and it takes us right back to Ukraine and how much it has changed and scrambled politics in the West in Western Europe and in Germany in particular. Just to take us back two decades, the German government decided that it wanted to phase out reliance on nuclear power after the Fukushima incident in Japan back in 2011. Then Chancellor Angela Merkel pushed for a rapid phase out of the nuclear power plants in Germany. Germany is now down to 3 nuclear power plants, and the expectation was they would close at the end of the year. Once the invasion of Ukraine took place, there were calls for Germany to reconsider that decision. And the word out of Berlin was, we won't do that because we're committed to this policy. And then after a few months, it changed to, well, we can't do that because it's too difficult and we don't have the fresh fuel rods. And then it came down to, well, we'll think about doing that, but we really don't want to do it. And now, given the real energy challenge that Germany faces, it appears that the Germans are going to keep those plants open. Now, I should note that there's been no formal decision. I believe it may even require a ratification by the German Bundestag. I would assume that if the chancellor makes that request, it would be approved. But again, you have a coalition government. One of the major parties in the government is the Green Party. And a lot of Green Party rank and file members are not happy that the consequence of the Ukraine war is that Germany is relying more on coal and is going to keep its nuclear program alive. So I guess there's a potential you could get a backbenchers rebellion. I don't think it's highly likely. But it gets us back to the position that the Germans have placed themselves in. The Germans constructed an economic model that relied in great extent to have access to inexpensive Russian gas. That gas is going away. Right now, I think the pipeline coming from Russia is at 20% capacity. That's not because of technical reasons. That's because of a decision made by the Russians. The summer, again, is a time when you build up your natural gas supply so you can get through a winter. And Germany is looking at a winter in which it will not have enough natural gas, which provides something like 20 to 25% of its energy needs. Now, there's a bit of a mismatch because nuclear plants will generate electricity. I think maybe 5% of Germany's overall electricity production. And the big problem the Germans face is not having enough natural gas, not just to run their companies, but also to heat homes. So it's a bit of a mismatch in terms of energy sources and energy needs. But obviously, to the extent that you can substitute one for another, it eases what looks to be a very difficult next 6 months, not just for Germany, but for Europe more broadly when it comes to energy.
And it's worth repeating, as Germany goes, so goes Europe in many ways. It's most powerful, certainly the most powerful economic country, hugely influential, and a country that had been accused up until recently of complacency, certainly as regards its energy portfolio, as you mentioned, Jim. I mean, it was willing to increase its reliance on Russia well after the annexation of Crimea and well after it was clear Russia had ramped up its disinformation campaigns, whether it was elections or otherwise, and other very troubling rhetoric and moves coming out of Moscow. And yet, you know, what we've seen in the last 6 months has been a real sea change. And you're looking at, as you know, coalition government. You've got Green Social Democrats, the Libertarian FDP, and they're having a moment, you know, a gut check moment for the country. And it's going to be very interesting to see how Germany goes. Other countries are struggling in Europe right now with populism, as well as with keeping their economies in order and dealing with inflation and so forth. So these 3 nuke plants are very symbolic. I can see why our audience chose it.
I agree, Bob.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. The UN Security Council debates common security through dialogue and cooperation. Imagine that. And parliamentary elections take place in Angola.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The articles and podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Marcus Zacharia, with senior podcast producer Gabrielle Sierra. Marcus also engineered this episode. Thank you, Marcus. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch and Rafaela Siewert for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrera and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying so long.
And this is Bob McMahon saying goodbye and be careful out there.